So today I'm going to talk about a case from The Gateless Barrier, which is this book, also known as The Gateless Gate sometimes, also known as the Mumon Kan. And this is a collection of Zen stories, or koans, compiled by a guy named Wu Men in China in 1229. So these are old stories. And I'll provide just a little background before I get into discussing this particular case, which is on your program. For those of you who picked up programs, you'll be able to follow along. And do a lot of you not have programs? I wonder if someone could go out and see Stacy, thank you, and maybe pass those around so folks can follow along. So these are koans. These are mostly stories about encounters between masters and students. And these are designed to challenge us and kind of shake us out of our ordinary way of thinking, because these stories don't really make logical sense. In the Rinzai tradition, a koan will usually be assigned by a teacher, and the student will sit with the koan and internalize it, spend a lot of time with it, go back to the teacher and make an attempt to demonstrate an understanding of the koan. We don't really do that in Soto Zen, which is our tradition. More often, we use these koans just for teaching purposes. The koan I'm talking about today is called Two Monks Roll Up the Blinds. And this is a story about the Chinese teacher Fa Yin. He's known as Hogen in Japanese. He lived from 885 to 958. So that's toward the end of the golden age of Chinese Zen, for those of you who are interested in Zen history. And he founded something called the Fa Yin School, which was the fifth of the five most prominent Zen traditions in China. So I'm going to start by just reading the case along with Wu Men's comment and Wu Men's verse. And then we'll go through it. So, here is the case. The great Fa Yin of Qingliang took the high seat before the midday meal to preach to his assembly. Raising his hand, he pointed to the bamboo blinds. Two monks went and rolled them up in the same manner. Fa Yin said, "One gains, one loses." So here's Wu Men's comment. "Tell me, which one gained, which one lost? If you have the single eye regarding this, you will see where the national teacher Qingliang failed. But I must warn you strictly against arguing gain and loss." And then here is Wu Men's verse. "When they are rolled up, the great sky is bright and clear, but the great sky still does not match our way. Why don't you just throw away that sky completely? Then not a breath of wind will come through." So what do we make of this? Often when we first read these things, we find that they make no sense at all. And it takes a little reflection. And I've had a little time to reflect on these. And I've also looked up a few commentaries so I could see what other people have to say about this story. And I'll just acknowledge them up front. Robert Aitken, Katsuki Sakita. I looked at a commentary from the Ordinary Mind Zendo in New York City, which I think had no name on it, and two Dharma talks by James Miyun Ford from Boundless Way Zen. So my gratitude to those folks. So I'm going to go through this line by line, and then at the end I'm going to ask the question, what does this mean for our practice? So we'll start with the case. The great Fa Yin of Qingliang took the high seat before the midday meal to preach to his assembly. So it starts with the great Fa Yin. I think that the use of the great is deliberate. There are some earlier stories about Fa Yin where he's not the master. He is instead the student. And he didn't really have full understanding yet. And here is one of those stories, which may be familiar to some of you. Ti Tsang, who's the teacher in this story, asked Fa Yin, who is the student, "What is your journey?" Fa Yin said, "Going around on pilgrimage." Ti Tsang said, "What do you expect from pilgrimage?" Fa Yin said, "I don't know." Ti Tsang said, "Not knowing is most intimate." So here Fa Yin is the student. This exchange caused him to switch teachers and become Ti Tsang's student. He saw something very wonderful in that, not knowing is most intimate. But now Fa Yen is the great Fa Yen, and he has behind him many years of practice, and he's the abbot, and he's worth listening to. I think that's what they're telling us here. The great Fa Yen of Qingliang, Qingliang is the name of his temple. Later they refer to him as Qingliang because sometimes the place and the name would get kind of interchangeable, took the high seat before the midday meal to preach to his assembly. So he's giving a Dharma talk, that's all. Just like we do on our retreats. The Dharma talk still comes before the midday meal. 1,000 years later. That's pretty cool. If you're into tradition, it's good to find something to do that has a long tradition, I think. Raising his hand, he pointed to the bamboo blinds. So he's pointing to the blinds. I think this is pretty simple, at least on one level. He did this for the very practical reason that the sun had probably risen high enough by now that the blinds weren't needed anymore, and he wanted the room to be filled with natural light. So he was, in effect, simply asking somebody to raise the blinds. But we could read more into this. The blinds keep out the natural light. The blinds are kind of a barrier between the zendo, where our practice is easiest, and the outside world, where our practice is the most difficult. And raising the blinds eliminates that barrier between what we see as our Zen practice and what we see as life, which may be outside of our Zen practice. So maybe he's asking the monks to eliminate this distinction between practice and life. And also, these commentators I read, I think they all pointed out that it's significant that Fa Yen merely points. He just points. That's all he does. He doesn't say anything. It's a pure gesture, kind of like raising one finger, which we see in another koan. There's no talking yet to muddle things up. This pure act of pointing breaks through all of our mental constructs. And Aitken says, here it is, its own pageant. Fa Yen has expounded the sutra. Pretty cool. Like Buddha raising the flower, and Maha Kashyapa saw what he was doing. Just saying, well, if I use words now. So this simple act of pointing is the whole deal. That's it. Nothing else is needed. But this is a koan. This is a Dharma talk. This is a teaching opportunity. You have to say something. So there's a lot more. Two monks rolled them up in the same manner. So two monks jumped up and did what Fa Yen wanted. In the same manner, I think, is important. They did it just the same. The two of them did it just the same. Another translation says they did it simultaneously, and I think that's not quite right. We'll get back to this in a minute. Fa Yen says, one gains, one loses. So it seems that he is comparing the two monks. The great Zen master is making a comparison. Robert Aitken says, comparisons are odious in Zen. What's going on here? We'll get back to this too. There's a way of looking at this story that is, we could say, kind of close to the surface. I don't want to say superficial because it's useful even though it's close to the surface. And I don't think this is what was intended by the koan, but as I said, I think it's useful, so I'm going to talk about it. And that way is to say that the two monks did that simple act of rolling up the blinds in two different ways. We can imagine one was on each side, and this one over here was just rolling up the blinds, doing nothing else, just giving it his full attention, as is appropriate for the zendo. And the other may have done it with all kinds of mental activity. Is this what the master really wants? Am I going to impress the master? What's everyone else going to think of the fact that I jumped up? Is that a good thing or a bad thing for me? All kinds of mental activity could be going on there. And so Fa Yen can see that. He can see that the one is doing it in kind of a distracted way. He doesn't have that sort of purity of motion. So he says something positive about the good monk and something negative about the bad monk. He's admonishing one of the monks. And this kind of approach, comparing a teacher comparing one monk to another, can be useful. If I compare my own practice to that of someone else, it can be useful. And in fact, I've thought of this story many times during retreat. And I think of the two monks, and I think, well, I'd like to be the good monk, not the bad monk. I'm going to come back here, and I'm going to really make this effort. This is self talking to self, and it helps to bring the self back to discipline. So it can be a useful thing. But this, I think, is not the intention of the koan. That's because the koan says that the two monks rolled up the blinds in the same manner. There was no difference in their actions. And as the Ordinary Mind website said, I don't think we should get the idea that Fa Yen could somehow kind of see into their minds and knew that even though they looked like they were doing it just the same, one had a busy mind and one did not. I don't think that's what's going on here. I think Fa Yen is trying to go much deeper than that. So let's go on to Wu Men's comment. Tell me, which one gained, which one lost? So Wu Men is posing that deeper question. How can Fa Yen say one gains, one loses about two monks who are doing exactly the same thing? How can a revered Zen master get caught up in making such a distinction? The next line, if you have the single eye regarding this, you will see where the national teacher Qing Liang failed. Wow. Is this Wu Men saying that Fa Yen is simply wrong? What's going on here? The single eye, if you have the single eye regarding this. The single eye, I think, as Aitken says, is the eye that sees beyond duality, that sees beyond distinction. If we're able to see in a way that is beyond distinctions, we can see that there's something kind of wrong about this distinction that Fa Yen has made. You can't divide the world up in this way, not in Zen. And Wu Men says just that. But I must warn you strictly against arguing gain and loss. But I don't think that Wu Men is saying that Fa Yen was just plain wrong. Wu Men has taken pains to tell us that Fa Yen is both great and a national teacher. I think Wu Men is playing with us a little bit here. He's kind of inviting us into a trap. He's kind of inviting us to say, yeah, I'm beyond distinctions, and I got this right, and Fa Yen is wrong. Wu Men and I, we got it, but Fa Yen did not. So gain and loss. Gain and loss, you could say, is about measuring. By measuring, I mean using our mental constructs to bring order to the world. This is left brain thought. This is what our brains habitually do and are hardwired to do in order to help us survive. Our brains will try to impose order on anything. And in a sense, this order we impose is always arbitrary. It can never reflect what actually is. It can only be an approximation of what actually is. We make distinctions, we make judgments, we have preferences. And all of those things have their place. But the dominance of that kind of thinking prevents us from seeing our quiet minds, from returning to silence, as Katagiri would say. So this koan, I think, can be seen as being about our relationship to this measuring mind. Fa Yen, when he says one gains, one loses, is measuring. Wu Men, in his comment, is basically saying, Fa Yen, or at least the stance that Fa Yen is playfully taking here, is wrong. You can't measure. So let's go forward into Wu Men's verse. When they are rolled up, the great sky is bright and clear. Rolling up the blinds, I think, can be seen as our practice, paying close attention to each thing we do. We roll up the blinds very carefully. Anything we do, we're doing very carefully if we're paying attention to our practice. And when the blinds are rolled up, when we have some discipline, when we're finding that place of quiet, when we're just there with our task, then we're the good monk and not the bad monk, and we find that place of quiet. We find our true nature. And the great sky is bright and clear. And it's not just the great Fa Yen. The sky is great, the world is great, and there's no you or me or Fa Yen about it. It's just great. Bright and clear. And Robert Aitken says, sky is a translation of the Sanskrit word shunyata, which means emptiness. This is the great sky of emptiness. It's that not knowing of not knowing is most intimate, and it's the I don't know of Bodhidharma. I'm still quoting Aitken here. It is before thinking, and it's complete presence with what is. It's not hindered by thought. It's beyond distinctions. But the great sky still does not match our way. At last we get to the heart of the matter here. Our way is Zen, the practice of Zen. But somehow the great sky of emptiness even, cannot match our way. How can that be? Why is Wu Min telling us this? Why don't you throw away that sky completely? Wu Min here, I think, one way to look at this koan anyway, is that he's giving us a warning about practice. He is warning us that although that sky, that dwelling in emptiness, is something that our practice brings us to, and it's beautiful, and it's free, it can also be a trap. Especially if we have an initial encounter with emptiness, it can be a basis for delusion. We can look at dwelling in emptiness as a trap in a couple of different ways. First way that emptiness can be kind of a trap, as soon as we experience some real quiet, we are quite astounded. It's quite wonderful. And we can easily begin to look at that quiet as a thing and think that we have achieved something. And there we are, just like that, back in the world of distinctions. It's a thing. The reason we got there in the first place is because we gave up the idea that anything can be a thing. So we're like, emptiness, I have found emptiness. So you found emptiness with the absence of I. But here's the I coming back in. We get attached to the great sky. And Wu Min tells us that we have to throw away that sky completely. We have to throw away our attachment to emptiness. We can't let emptiness be a thing. When we first saw emptiness, we saw that it was just this. It's not a thing. It's just this, whatever that is. Just this right now. Emptiness, still, after we've seen it, is just this. But now, just this may be our attachment to emptiness. It's not that thing that we thought it was before. It's what it is right now. It's probably what was happening before, falling apart right now. Let's be with the falling apart. Let's not go back to what we're looking for. If we have expectations of this moment, we can't be in this moment. If we think this moment's going to be a certain way, there's no way we're going to be in it. So, how else can emptiness be a trap? We can get the idea that emptiness is something special. That dwelling in emptiness means that we're somehow removed from this mundane world. That we can begin dwelling in some kind of nirvana paradise. And probably most of us kind of started out with that idea, that we were headed for some kind of different way of being. Where we have no problems and everything is okay and we never have preferences and there's no judgment and thoughts no longer exist. But it's not like that. We still need to have thoughts in order to survive. And once we experience emptiness in a small way or a big way or maybe a very big way, we still must go back to engaging ordinary mind. It has to be this way. Because emptiness encompasses ordinary mind. It encompasses measurement. But once we experience emptiness, that relationship is different. Different. It's kind of about who's running the show. When we have that super busy mind, or maybe an anxious mind, or in extreme cases, even a panicky mind, it seems to us that that is us. Panicky mind equals Ted, you know? That is me. But perhaps with practice, I begin to stand aside from that a little bit and see, well, that's not all of me. There's this place of quiet, too. And maybe I practice a lot, and there's this place of quiet. And, oh, yeah, I see that how that incorporates this little panicky mind. There's really quite a shift there from panicky mind running the show to that which is encompassing panicky mind. Why don't you throw away that sky completely? Here Wu Men is really challenging us, and it's so hard to put this into words. Throw away even the distinction between measurement and non-measurement, between earth and sky, between delusion and enlightenment, between the mind of emptiness and ordinary mind. Forget everything I've said this morning because it's all wrong. I've used distinctions to talk about getting beyond distinctions. It's really not possible to say what throwing the sky away completely is, really. But we can say what it looks like, and the last line of the verse does just that. It says, "Then not a breath of wind will come through." Another translation says, "And keep your practice so close that no air can escape." What I want to do is combine those two lines and get a really nice line that says, "Keep your practice so close that not a breath of wind can come through." Keep your practice close. What does that mean? It means being right here. It means that there's no gap between you and the act. It is simply happening. That's what is right here. Nothing extra. We're right here in the quiet moments. We're right here in the distracting moments. We're right here in the distracting, busy world. And there's no distinction between the distracting, busy world and our practice. And Mion Ford says about this moment, "Here self and other fall away. Here the chanting happens. Here everything is just as it is. And here, at this moment, in this breath, all things are saved. Keep your practice so close that not a breath of wind can come through." Because in this breath, there can't be anything else. If we're truly close to our practice in this moment, there can be no other moment. But I like best Aitken's comment on what it's like to throw away the sky completely. He says, "I would say it is the cardinal singing on the telephone wire. Everything else drops away." So, just this simple image, no words. It's not a thing. Okay, we're using a word to describe it, cardinal. But it's just... So we're back, kind of, to Fa Yen pointing at the blinds. He's just pointing. He's coming from a place of emptiness, and he's acting in the world in a practical way, and there's no distinction between those two things. That's the true Fa Yen. And then we have the Fa Yen who's playing with us, saying these two monks are different. He's saying there is a place for distinctions in the enlightened mind. The two monks are different, and they are not. And what do we do with that? We hold these two opposite ideas at the same time. Until that part of our mind that loves distinctions so much falls away, at least for a while, for a moment, maybe for good, and it's free, and then it's just the cardinal on the telephone wire. And I heard one the other day, about two mornings ago, in the morning as I left my house, and it was, "Hello, cardinal." That was vivid after that long winter. So what does this mean for our practice? There are many possible answers to that question, but I'd like to focus on one. This koan, as I said, I think is about our relationship to measuring mind. First it's a problem, then it goes away, then it comes back. So remember how I talked about the less deep view of the monks rolling up the blinds together, and one is doing it right, one is doing it wrong, and that can be useful. If I'm in the Zendo and I'm doing Kinhin, walking meditation, and I see someone doing it in such a light, easy, and focused way that I know they're not distracted, I can compare myself to that person and think, well, I would like to be like that. And that's helpful, and that's mind talking to mind. And similarly, if I can get my mind involved if I use it as an aid to meditation, such as counting my breaths. And what would Fa Yen say about this? I would think he would say it could be pretty helpful. And we may need to do that kind of thing for a long time. Usually, I've been practicing a long time, and usually I do shikantaza, just sitting, or standing, or walking, or whatever I'm doing. But there are occasions now and then when still I go back to counting breaths. Sometimes I've had a very busy day, and my mind is very, very active, and it doesn't want to slow down, and I have a hard time sleeping. And when that happens, I go back to counting my breaths just as I was taught to do 22 years ago in a Korean temple. And I use these words, ha na tul set net tasut. And when I first heard those words, I thought they must be something pure and mystical and beautiful. And I found out they translate as 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I was a little disappointed, but I think there may be a lesson in there. So this kind of discipline, this kind of involving the mind in the process is something you do, but it's not something you do forever. Eventually, you let go. Important to think of that. And I'm thinking, kind of reaching for a simile here, I'm thinking about the first truck that I bought, the first vehicle I bought. It was a 54 Chevy. It was a 3/4-ton truck, and it had a camper on it. So it was a large pickup. And I lived in that when I was building grain elevators. And it also came with its original grain box. So it was meant for hauling grain. And it had this super low gear. Some people call it a granny gear. I think that's a little disrespectful to grannies, so I'm going to call it super low. But think of the lowest gear. If you've had a vehicle with a manual transmission, think of the lowest gear. And then think of a gear much lower than that. It was designed to get the truck moving in really difficult conditions. Maybe you're in the field with a full load of grain, which weighs, I don't know, how much, maybe a ton or so. And maybe the ground is a little wet. And you really need something extra in that situation to get going. So you put it in super low, and it makes this really pleasing sound, and it just barely starts moving at this incredibly slow speed. But of course, it's just to get you rolling. As soon as you get a little motion, you have to shift into the next gear, which is sort of the regular low. If you stayed in super low, it would take you about an hour to get out of the field or more, and it would probably damage the truck, because the truck is not meant to operate that way. And that's the kind of thing that mind talking to mind is for. It's just to get you started in difficult situations. And I don't want to take this simile too far, but we can get pretty mired, you know? We can get pretty mired in pretty difficult conditions, and just getting going is not easy. And we're in the midst of severe monkey mind, and in the midst of mind that just won't settle down. But you let it go eventually. You leave that measuring mind behind. You have to leave it behind completely before you can think about reintegrating it, about having a new relationship with it. So in Zen, in the truck, you're in super low for just a little while, 10 seconds, 30 seconds, I don't remember really. But in Zen, it can last a long time. It can last a long time. And you might still be coming back to it 20 years later when you need it. But remember, the distinctions we make in our thoughts do not match our way. Even the great sky does not match our way. So eventually, please, throw away that sky completely. But the great news is that even though I talk about, I'm making this analogy as if there were this series of gears we could advance through in Zen, that's really not the case. That's really not the case, because you can go into fifth just like that. Even if you've never sat before, even in your first meditation, that's going to happen. It may be so quick you don't see it. It may not be. You may be fully there right here, right now. That's the good news about this. Full opportunity for full realization every moment. We have this tedious practice. Sometimes it's tedious discipline, but we don't get trapped there. When the world presents itself, wake up. When the cardinal is on the wire, let the cardinal be on the wire. So to finish up, I'd just like to talk about a little cardinal on the wire moment that I had. When we talk about waking up, it's about being awake in every moment, no matter how mundane or boring or routine, every moment. It's not about just being awake in sort of those dramatic moments. But I'm going to talk about a dramatic moment because sometimes a dramatic moment can remind us what being awake is. I'm thinking of Katagiri's moose. He would say, if I remember this correctly, that being awake was like encountering a moose crossing the road. It really gets your attention. So in my Dharma, I gave a Dharma talk maybe in August, and I was back from Glacier National Park, and I think I briefly mentioned that my wife, Kathy, and I had had a close encounter with a bighorn sheep. And when that happened, there was another hiker there, and she came up to us after we encountered the bighorn sheep, and she said, "That was crazy, and I took photos of you, and I'm going to send those to you." And I thought, wonderful, I'd love to see those. And they didn't come, and they didn't come, and I thought she must have forgotten. Then about 2 weeks ago, she sent these photos. So I've got these two photos, and I'll put these on the bulletin board out there so you can check them out as you're leaving today. And I'm not really into photos very much. All over Glacier, people were taking pictures all the time, you know, and I thought, can't you just put your camera down for a minute and kind of see what's going on without something being there in between you and the thing? I mean, at the greatest moments of your lives, what are you doing? You're taking a picture of it. I mean, that's okay. I guess I'm being overly critical. So I'm not into photos very much, but I love these pictures. These are the coolest things ever. And what happened was we were hiking in this kind of scree on the side of a mountain, and we were hiking down a path, and we saw this bighorn sheep, and I'd never seen one of these before in my life, except maybe in a zoo or something. It was coming toward us, and we're on this path, and it's walking straight toward us, but it's up the hill a little, 10 feet or so. Actually, in this picture, it looks like about 20 feet. It felt like about 5 feet. We thought we were really close. And so we're walking toward him, and he's walking toward us, and what do we do? Well, I suppose we could kind of scamper out of the way, but that doesn't seem really safe, so we just kind of keep going toward us. And he comes toward us, and he is walking in this very stern and dignified manner, you know, like he doesn't even really see us. It's like, this is my mountain. I'm in charge here, and I'm walking right here. And so we kind of see him coming, and we kind of stop, and Kathy kind of gets behind me, and I say to her, "Don't look him in the eye." And that is advice that I had gotten for bears. And I don't know if it applies to bighorn sheep, but it's worth a try, you know. And this thing is big. A male, and this was a male, they can weigh 300 to 500 pounds. They are big. The horns alone can weigh 30 pounds. These are big horns. He could really hurt us. So we just kind of stood there, and we stood there very quietly, and we tried to be kind of small. And I tried my best to just have a very, very quiet mind, you know. I thought, maybe he can sense that. And he just comes walking along, and then he stops for a moment, and he looks at us, and we look at him. And he keeps walking. Wow. And this photo kind of captures that, which is why I love it. It kind of captures, I think, that raw moment of just sort of pure alertness with nothing extra. And that's how we can be with every moment. We can be that way. It doesn't have to be with the bighorn sheep. It can be right out here as you're stepping out of the zendo. It can be when you're putting your shoes on. So, yeah, so that's it. I'll put these up on the bulletin board. Thank you so much for listening this morning. And if anyone has a comment or a question, I'd love to hear it. And if not, that's okay, but we'll sit for a moment and see if something comes up.
My question is, what does it mean to gain something and lose something?
What does it mean? Well, I think that means to use measuring mind, or that reflects a way of looking at the world in which we measure things. And we do that all the time. As I said, our mind loves to do that, and it has its usefulness. But it's not a place we want to come from all of the time. I think gaining and losing is any kind of comparison. Any kind of comparison.
That doesn't seem like a Zen way of gain. I mean, it seems like that there really is no gain or loss in Zen, so why would a Zen master talk about gain and loss?
Right, right. I think he's playing with us a little bit to kind of provoke us into thinking about that. And I think he's also talking about how even though we completely let go of gaining and losing, and sort of understand that this in this world everything is relative and interdependent, at the same time, this relative interdependent world does have that aspect in which things can be differentiated. And it's kind of our koan, it's kind of our personal journey, a challenge to us to kind of work out that relationship. How is it that things can be different? You know, how can Ben and I be two different people and yet we know we're not? We're really not. So we have a big question mark here. Yes?
Well, stories are useful to help us, but they're just stories. Who knows what was going on and what Wu Man said?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you were there. If there was such a meeting.
Right. Right. And there are many possible ways of interpreting this, I think. But who knows? A story is just a story. You're right. Yes?
I think maybe you might be pointing to our ideas of gain and loss. And one thing I pictured that might be going on, if this story is literally true and actually taking place, is that maybe one of the monks was fumbled a little bit with the shade and the other put it up perfectly, and in which case the one fumbling with the shade would actually be paying more attention to putting the shade up than the one who does it perfectly, and he might have been pointing that out.
Kind
of the way that Suzuki talks about the horses, and we all think, oh, beating that first horse sounds nice, and then after the fourth one he says, but, you know, who's paying more attention to their practice, who just beat that horse than before, so.
Right.
Right. Our ideas, I mean, aside from the fact that gain and loss are making distinctions and stuff, I think we tend to reverse them.
Yeah, the story of the worst horse, and it's about how the worst horse is really the most fortunate one, the one that just doesn't do very well, that really needs the whip in order to do anything at all.
But to pay attention.
And I frequently go back to that when I'm feeling like the worst horse. Okay, this is better. Now, why was that better? Thanks. Yes, Paul?
Is absolute truth and relative truth, if I have the terms right?
I think that works.
That plays with this, same concept.
Absolute and relative.
Yeah.
I would say so. Yeah, and that's a useful way of talking about the world, where everything is interdependent, nothing has substance of its own, nothing exists separate from everything else, and yet we can identify these separate things, and that's the big question. How can these things be true at once? You know?
Yeah.
If this is all such an illusion, how come I'm talking to you now?
I was watching a heated discussion between two people about that. No, it's all, you know, saying, no, what is it? This is a chair.
Yeah.
I don't mean to say this is that. You know.
Right, right.
They were both right. Tell them no.
Right. Well, and of course, the Zen answer to that is, you know, it's this. Yes?
Is the idea of return. So I think early on you quoted the phrase, return to silence.
Mm-hmm.
And then a little later you talked about return remember what adjective you used, but the normal mind or the... and what strikes me about that is how that trip, thinking about it that way, that how that trip affects both minds. You know what I mean? So one thing I think about a lot is sort of like a beginning in practice is how my busy mind affects my attempt at an empty mind. But then this also prompts me to think about how an empty mind might impact my busy mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
And then that makes me ask another question, which is all the other kinds of, all the different flavors, all the varieties of busy mind and empty mind, how do they impact each other? When we experience them, how do they change each other?
You know, yeah, you know, I'm comfortable with just kind of leaving that question out there and not answering it. I think the question, it's a great question. Thank you.
Dennis?
Yes?
You probably answered this, but I would like you to speak to it again. You gave us two different interpretations, the more close to the surface one.
Mm-hmm.
I love them both. I really love that deeper one. I hadn't heard that. What I'm wondering is where Wuman said that he had failed. Is he referring to, which one of the interpretations is he referring to? Can you say something about that?
Which interpretation is Wu Men referring to when he says, you will see where the national teacher failed? So if you have the single eye regarding this, if you are beyond distinctions, you will see that he failed in saying one gains, one loses. To me, he's talking there. If you have the single eye beyond duality, then you can see that Fa Yen failed in making these comparisons because he was invoking something dualistic.
So he was referring to the more shallow interpretation.
I think so.
The deeper interpretation that you talked about, right?
Mm-hmm. I'll go sit with that one for a while. You know, that's a good question.
Well, I think the next statement, but I must warn you strictly against arguing gain and loss. So I think he's saying, okay, if you're looking at it with that interpretation, you know, then you'll see that he failed, but don't look at it that way, because this is the great Fa Yen. That's where I go with that.
If you look at it really deeply, to the kind of mind which, empty mind which encompasses gain and loss, then arguing gain and loss is okay, I think. So, that, we're coming from a different direction here if we're talking about that.
Because then you're talking about realizing that we live in this world for gain and loss.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 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 And if that's the case, then he didn't really fail, right?
Exactly.
If he's saying we can incorporate gain and loss into our worldview, which sees everything as interdependent.
Well, and that was my question. Was he seriously saying that he failed? In other words, he was looking only at the more shallow interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Or was he just trying to be provocative?
I think he's playing with this and saying, if you have the shallow interpretation, yeah, he failed. If you have the deep interpretation, he did not fail.
Okay. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for helping me clarify that. Now I can rewrite the talk and start with that at the beginning. Okay. Yes.
So, Paul, I had a similar take on this to what you suggested earlier about the kind of mundane and super mundane, right? So, like, there are two guys rolling the blinds in the same manner, right? So I think he's saying that everything, every phenomenon has this mundane aspect and the super mundane, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a really good teaching, right? Mundane stuff and then emptiness and Buddha nature and whatever. but then I think the comment in the verse are that this is Dogen, right? This is like the mundane and the super mundane are buddies, right?
Yeah.
So I think he's kind of bringing it back together with the comment in the verse.
Yeah, very good. Okay, yes.
We talked about measuring mind, and we talked about Korea 1, 2, 3, 4. It got me thinking about an article this week I read about the SAT test being redefined.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself thinking, I wonder if I get it better or worse. And then I started thinking, really a strange thing and, a sad thing to be thinking about.
Yeah.
And then I started thinking, that's a problem in Zen. I'm pretty good at thinking about things, and then Zen tells me not thinking. I think that's my experience from listening to people here is that there's a lot of people that are good at thinking about things. So I then went on to think maybe the SAT score should have an SIT score.
Very good. Very good. Very good. Yeah. Because in Zen, you really can't have winners and losers. You never win. But even at Zen, you want to win, Okay, when do I get that Zen certificate? The SIT score, I like it. Okay, well, maybe one more? If there's one more? Yes.
This is the first time I've been here, so I am approaching this completely new way.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look at this, I wonder why there is the word grace, cyan. Grace is the word that we use to signify amounts or places of significance. And then this person takes a high seat above the other people and then raises his hand and he points and observes other people and says, one gains, one loses. He himself is a distinction between his greatness and the others who are lesser than. And then Wuman's comment, tell me, which one gained? Which one lost? Why is there a distinction between this Saiyan and the other? I'm new to this. I don't understand why there should be a distinction between Saiyan and the others, or the monk, or anyone else.
That's an interesting way to look at it. And that's a good question. Is it helpful to have those distinctions? The teacher-student distinction, where we say some people have studied long enough, done this long enough, that they can be helpful to others, that it'll be helpful if we designate that they're teachers and other people are students. And some people say yes, that can be helpful, and some people say no. And it's a really good question. And we have some hierarchies in Zen, some hierarchies that have been part of the tradition for a long time, and people have various degrees of comfort with those. And we're always kind of trying to work it out, and we keep asking the questions. And I think it's very good to answer the question. I personally think some distinctions are useful. I think you have to be really careful with distinctions. But I think it's something we need to keep working on.
Can I say one thing?
Okay, one thing.
Sorry, just really quick. I feel like some of those questions are just to do with sort of the historical nature of Zen in China and its attempt to establish various streams of Zen in China's attempt to establish legitimacy of lineage and stuff like that. And so when we see things like the Great Fa Yen, things like that, partially those things are people sort of like jockeying for position and lineage and trying to establish
mm-hmm.
legitimacy. And, you know, whether that's fortunate or unfortunate is you know, is an open question, but I think it's something worth observing about the language of some of these things.
Right. Very good. Okay. Well, thanks, everyone, for your attention and for the wonderful comments.